Okay, and we're back. Cannot raise Dr. Nick on the telephone tonight, so Election Day, even though I may be very busy up there in Alaska. What we're going to do is, and boy, did I get a lot of email requesting to be able to hear John Hoag again, the brilliant Nostradamus scholar, in our wide-ranging conversation we had on the 30th of October. So we're going to do that. Enjoy it. It's a great program with John Hoag coming up right now. Okay, welcome back. Hope you had a good weekend as we walk into another week, the last week in October already. Wow. November here, next week, and then December, and then we're off to 2007, wherever that may lead. John Hoag has been with us for many years on the program, talking about his extraordinary scholarship in terms of, well, I've termed him without question the world's foremost expert on Nostradamus. I don't think anyone will argue that. John has been here many times, talked about things that apparently are discernible clearly to John, and maybe less clearly to John in some cases, but he is as good as they get. About our times, about where we're going, about what may happen in the very near future. If you don't know about John Hoag, please click on his name and go to his website. It's Hoag, H-O-G-U-E, prophecy.com. John is the author of 9 books, over 1 million in print in 17 languages to date. And we're very glad to have him back tonight as, once again, Nostradamus prophecies are in the news on the net, and we'll find out more now. Hello, my friend. How are you?
Hello, Jeff. Happy Good. Halloween.
Ah, yes. And pray tell, who are you dressing up as? A little joke there, John.
Well, I should dress up as Hillary Clinton.
Actually. No, you don't want to scare anybody. Come on.
Well, the reason why, actually, where I live, I have about 500 kids come up the street.
That would be cruel and inhuman punishment. You might be arrested or reported to DHS.
Well, you know why I say this. I just realized, just before the show began, that 8 years ago, on this date, in New York City, on the studio stage of The View, I predicted that Hillary Clinton, who was then running for senator, would not only win her senatorial race in 98, but in 2008 be president of the United States.
You know, I hate to say this, folks, but tell us about your record, my friend.
Well, if I'm right about Clinton, Clinton this time, it'll be 11-0.
Now, I hope all of you heard that. That 11-0 as in perfect. He hasn't missed. This is, this is scary stuff because, of course, she will do nothing different than anyone else is. Well, a little surface eyewash, but it's going to be the same old crap.
What she will be we're in this incredible karmic echo right now. The whole country is described in prophecy. There are a lot of things going patterns and waves, and they're often based on generational changes. And the karmic echo we're in is almost exactly a reverse of what happened 40 years ago. So it's saying that the country had a bunch of important lessons to learn. All of us together as a collective called Americans had lessons to learn that we didn't learn, so they've come back in more magnified forms. The surface has slightly changed. I'll give you a few examples. You know, 40 years ago, we had a JFK win a disputed election and against a two-term vice president named Richard Nixon in 1960. 40 years later, two-term Al Gore disputed election in Florida. JFK was in the mix, but it was John Forbes Kerry, John F. Kennedy. We have a Texan president.
JFK, interesting.
Yeah. Texan president got in a spurious Gulf of Tonkin incident, into a war in Vietnam. A Texan Republican president, 40 years later, with spurious information, gets us into another Vietnam in the desert in Iraq.
I think we can just drop the word spurious and put in false and maliciously untrue.
Yes, propaganda for another agenda. Yeah. It's slowly hatching out, and
that's weird. Excuse me, John. Yeah. You got me with that JFK twice.
Yeah, isn't that strange?
That is.
There are a whole number of parallels that are quite shocking, and one will probably be that 40 years after Nixon won in 1968, you will see a reverse roles where you'll have a Nixonian Democrat winning.
Jeez.
And that'll be Hillary Clinton.
Well, may she wear the latex mask of Richard with pride.
Well, it's kind of ironic because, you know, she was a staunch, staunchly against him as a young college co-ed or something, and now, now she may actually face the same temptations Nixon faced, with the same potential for greatness, but the same potential to self-destruct like Nixon did.
Man, I gotta tell you, I'm no fan of Richard Nixon, but between the two of them, I gotta say that it's no contest. This woman is a dirtbag opportunist if there ever was one.
Well, and
say that about Nixon.
Well, it's interesting. Again, in prophecy, one of the secrets to having some accuracy in predicting the future is one has to suspend one's current opinion and delve into the opinion people will have in the future.
And
if we were talking 40 years ago mm-hmm. or 45 mm-hmm. years ago about the former Vice President Nixon, who is not going to be kicked around anymore, you know, Tricky Dick, as they used to call him, because of the old Douglas congressional election. People were saying exactly the same thing about Nixon, the new Nixon, in 66, thinking, oh, this guy's got no chance.
That's amazing.
But in the few years that followed, such huge things happened to the country, assassination of King, civil rights stuff, a rebellion in the streets over Vietnam, and suddenly the world that seemed so confidently Democrat Party controlled in America was turned upside down, and then old Jolly Nixon, who was not going to be kicked around anymore, Tricky Dick, became President of the United States in a close election in 1968 against Hubert Humphrey. And what I'm saying is everything's setting up to do the same thing again, and it's going to be a reverse roles where now the preeminent power in America, like 40 years ago, was Democrats, was now three tiers of the government dominated by the Republicans. Now the Republicans are in disarray, just like the Democrats were. And it's amazing to see how predictable this echo is, which really says beyond the echo of this repeated lesson that all of us in this country have a lesson, a karmic lesson to learn, or many lessons, and if we keep ignoring them, they keep coming back doubly strong. And we seem to be in a very, as we speak over our skies, there's some remarkable astrological fluences that are indicating that we are entering a really bumpy revelatory ride as Americans in the next year, starting with this election next week.
Let me think about this. Now, with Nixon and Humphrey, the possibility that the election was fixed exists. It was close.
It was actually more there's probably enough evidence to prove that Kennedy actually farther back, that the disputed election, which was exactly 40 years before the disputed Florida election, was the one where Mayor Daley and his Democratic hacks and mafia in Chicago
dead people voting
fudged the votes, and there was 110,000 vote difference, or 170,000, but the Humphrey election was 600,000 popular vote difference, so it's a little
I agree, but you know, what we have now, what we didn't have then, Hillary Clinton notwithstanding, is something called e-voting, electronic voting, which is now literally probably the biggest single issue Americans don't realize they're facing. They don't understand that the entire political process may be finished here as long as there is electronic voting, the Diebold, Sequoia, ESNS, and all the rest of it, and how easy it is to put in what they call software patches or fixes at the last minute.
From Venezuela.
Thank you. We're 2 years further down the road now, and they've gotten to be that much better. So some people say they'll never vote again as long as there is electronic voting, and I can sympathize with that. I do.
I can too, and also, but there's another element to this which makes the next week's election even more amazing, or more profound, and probably the most significant midterm election that will influence the future of the world. is that this is probably the last window, because there are so many of these voting ballot boxes that don't have a paper trail. Whereas in 2008, there probably will be a paper trail. So
yeah, but the paper, but John, as you know, the paper trail will be counted by computers.
Well,
that's how they have it set up.
Well, the thing is also that the, as usual, the party that has a donkey as its symbol doesn't look at the right places for voter fraud in the case of their own interests.
Right.
You can have a million Diebold voting boxes voting in just fine, but all of those get sent to a central computer, which
absolutely.
Is just one guy with a PC.
That's all. That's all it takes.
Yeah, one guy with a PC
right.
who can just change the numbers.
That's right.
Where are the voting monitors
right.
on him or
on
her?
Him. They're not. That's the whole point. We probably have lost forever, at least in terms of staying with electronic voting, the ability and the right and the constitutional guarantee of a free and fair election process. It doesn't happen. Too much power and too few hands, and it's corruptible. Vote flipping already being... we're going to talk later on in Hour 3 tonight with Brad Friedman about the latest in the whole horror train of voting irregularities that are beginning to show up already, even though the vote hasn't been even counted yet or even cast, because they're finding things already that are, shall we say, more than concerning in at least 10 states. So, yeah. And look how confident the village idiot sounds when he talks about retaining control of the House and Senate with Republicans. The guy acts like he's been told, doesn't he, John?
Well, there's a lot of prophetic stuff to support that it's going to be a chaos.
All right. I predict the most litigious election in U.S. history. We'll be right back. Okay, right back with all of you. Thanks for being here tonight. I hope you did have a good weekend. As I said, always a pleasure to spend time with John Hogue. John, been a friend for many years. He's brilliant, and if you missed it, he has nailed... If he wins... I shouldn't put it that way, should I, John? You're not betting.
Well, 10-0
betting
currently.
That's it. Right now, John is 10-0 in terms of picking the winners of presidential elections.
Now, I have to qualify that I pick the popular vote, because I just tune into the vibe of the people.
It works.
And so those of you who are out there screaming and yelling and saying, yeah, but he said Gore was going to win in 2000, I say, yes, he did win.
He did.
Sorry.
He actually did win. He won on all fronts.
And in fact, the butterfly ballot... you know, all the finger pointing at the poor Republicans in Florida is really missing the point. It was a Democrat operative who created the butterfly ballot in Palm Beach County that saw 20,000 misvotes for Pat Buchanan rather than Al Gore in a county that just was not pro Buchanan.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, folks who say, oh, well, the Republicans stole the election. No, the Democrats fumbled the election.
Well, and the Supreme Court came in to clean up the debris of uncertainty.
Yeah. And so it is, you know, it was, I said before, in fact, it's kind of become a tradition. The first national, international shows I do in my waves of predictions, it always seems to be you, Jeff.
Yeah, and I appreciate that. We've always had a good time, and it's just amazing. You do tune in on the consciousness of the country, and that's correct. With that said, Hillary Clinton of the White House is going to be so repulsive to so many people that I have to think that for you to be sensing this at this time, her machine has tentacles that go up to... for lack of a better word, the top. I mean, this woman, if she's in the White House, she's going to be put there. Let's put it that way.
Well, the thing that's again, amazing parallel is the road that she has taken slowly, inexorably, with great political savviness. It is echoed by what Nixon did 40 years ago in 1966.
When the woman is not stupid. Don't let anyone misunderstand her. She is anything but.
But she is, but she has, if people are following her progress, she is forging a middle-of-the-road embracing of collective values that is very much an evolution that's very similar to Nixon's silent majority. And
no, she's jumped back and forth across many fences and has played to attentive crowds. I understand that, and you're right, and it's something that we'll watch very closely. I agree.
The other thing to look at, too, is that Nixon, in a certain way, very skillfully made people think in the mythology of we had better times with Eisenhower when I was vice president. And in a ironic way.
Oh, very good.
Yeah,
very good observation.
In an ironic way, you watch Hillary Clinton, either directly or if she's as deftly political as Nixon, will make you feel in between the lines and the symbolism that, you know what, times were better when the Clintons were in the White House. Just
God.
Like times were better when Dick Nixon and Ike were in the White House.
You know, John, I got to hand it to you. Once again, you've touched on a very interesting scenario, and if they're not listening tonight, someone will tell them this is a subtle psychological foundation they need to start building, and you're right.
They're already doing it. In fact, you know, probably the advantage that Hillary Clinton has over Richard Nixon in this situation is that it's not one savvy political operator, it's two, her husband and her.
Yeah.
And they will be very successful in a dire, disjointed, chaotic time that is coming in 2008. A true crisis for the country is coming, starting New Year's onward, starting after this election.
Uh-huh.
And it will lead to a situation where the mythology, and it is a myth, that the Clinton times were better. In fact, a lot of the problems that have blossomed in the Bush era were seeded by Clinton and the Republican Congress together in the 90s.
Yep.
And we're reaping what we sowed in those times.
Well, the flood tide of American advanced military technology, software technology, the whole missile multi-independently retargetable vehicle, MIRV warheads, all of that and much, 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 much more went to the Chinese, our avowed enemies. Charles R. Smith says, Charlie says that the Chinese literally during the Clinton years advanced 30 to 35 years technologically because of the amount of sophisticated and allegedly off-limits in intelligence material, technological material, you name it, that was given to the Chinese or sold to the Chinese or stolen by the Chinese.
Add to that the disaster of George W. Bush selling the country to the same organizations in China, putting us in deep debt in China, that the greatest weapon that Iran will use in the coming war will not be military, but political and economic.
No, they'll just call Beijing and say, listen, you want this $500 billion in oil and gas that you've signed up for and much more, and you're going to better stop this this crap that these people are throwing at us.
Of course, and China will have another problem in 2008. They will be thrown a sneak punch by Taiwan.
All right, that's going to be probably timed for the Summer Olympics, which, of course, Beijing views as its ultimate entree, cachet, if you will, onto the world stage. They're really hoping that the 2008 Olympics will put them right in the catbird seat. And so Taiwan, if they're going to play a card, they better play it then, and that's what you're thinking, I assume.
Yes, 2008 is the window for a war, a Sino-Taiwanese war.
All right. Stand by, and for you sharp-eared listeners, you'll know we've talked about this in the past, and we've suggested that the Chinese, when they idly boast that they are preparing to fight and win an 8-day war with Taiwan, are not joking. I mean, that's what they're planning to do. So we will see. They want to make Taiwan into another Hong Kong is what they want. We will see. Very interesting conversation, always, with John Hogue. And we will continue it in just a few minutes. We'll be right back. Okay, let's get right back to John Hope. You know, man, what a scene. What a clever, and I think they could pull it off, John. Hoodwink the American public into subliminally, subconsciously, almost reflexively, wishing for those good old halcyon days of the Clintons. My God, but they don't, what they don't remember? Ron Brown? Vince Foster?
Yeah.
How much technology? 6 mainframe supercomputers sent to Beijing, allegedly on the promise of the Chinese they would only go to universities. Of course, they went right to the PLA and military defense. Advanced research and technology. The Loral missile catastrophe. I can't remember them all. And if you want to read about the Clinton White House, they talk about Bush's homosexuality and perversion. Yeah, oh, fine. But how about Gary Aldrich, the former FBI agent? He wrote a book called, let me think, Unlimited Access. Something like an FBI agent in the Clinton White House or something. Read about it, folks. Don't get fooled by that. But, you know, I'll tell you, the way the American public has been conditioned on the brilliance, and I do mean it, of this socially engineered society we're in, and its control, its abject control by the lapdog media, which is no more a media than, you know, a box of Kleenex anymore. They do what they're told, and that's it. I think they could pull it off. I hate to tell you this, but let me say one other thing. Jennifer Flowers, one of Clinton... Oh, and let's not forget the Clinton death wish. For God's death wish. How many were on the Clinton death wish? Death list. Wish list. He had a wish list. Oh, over 100 people, I think, were on the Clinton's death list altogether.
I'm sure George Bush has a long list, too.
Well, it's supposedly close to 60 or 70. But, yeah, it's growing. Man, when you think about that. Jennifer Flowers, here's what she said. She said in an interview in Mexico, this was shortly after a big flap about the Clinton death list, come to think of it. She said, mark my words, when Bill Clinton is gone, people are going to miss him. They're going to miss the Clinton days. Well, there you go.
Well, you know, it is, again, another interesting parallel that Nixon also had a famous list of subversives that he wanted to get rid of, that came to light after Watergate. Certainly, Nixon was obsessed with the liberal East Coast conspiracy that he thought was trying to supplant his power. Hillary Clinton, and the problem with all this kind of paranoia is, just because you have paranoia doesn't mean somebody isn't after you. There is some element of truth to all paranoid issues sometimes, and it is also true that there is a neocon right-wing conspiracy that's trying to basically foment a American version of fascism running this country, and that group that is behind the current administration is, I cannot imagine personally how they will allow any opposition succeeding on November 7th.
I agree. I've said for years, and perhaps even when you've been on the program before, that I think these people literally will try to take the whole thing down rather than give up or be displaced from their position of power and control that they have now.
Now
I think
you,
that evil.
Now, on top of that, you have one of the more least known but probably the most documented accurate prophet, I would argue, of the 20th century is not Edgar Cayce. Unfortunately, it's one of the 20th century's greatest criminals, Adolf Hitler.
Oh, yeah, and may I say something, please? All you have to do, you out there listening, when you hear John Hogue say that, is actually read what Hitler and Hitler's top people were saying in 1943 and 1944 when they began to see that the war was over, they were going to lose. They projected and predicted literally what the next 50-plus years would be, and they were dead on the money.
And one of the things he said, one of his last documented predictions before he committed suicide, was when he had finally had his nervous breakdown and admitted to himself the war was lost. Of course, they were literally knocking on his door, the Soviet soldiers by that time,
yeah,
in his bunker. But he said something to in German to translate that, you know, the National Socialism is dead and it will never rise again. If ever something similar to me, a person like me, were to come again, it might come in 100 years or so, and it would be linked to a religious movement. It would be more like a religious movement than a political movement.
Huh.
Now, You see, in a number of places in the world, people of extreme religious views trying to usurp political power. You see it in India. You see it in Pakistan. You see it in the Sunni and Shia states of Islam. And you see it right here in America.
That's right.
With evangelical neoconservatism, which even George Will, who is an undoubted great staunch conservative, has openly said, these people are not conservatives, they are radicals trying to overthrow the country.
All too true.
And I wonder if how many turns Goldwater is turning in his grave, thinking about how people in the name of conservatism.
Yeah. He got a bad rap, didn't he?
He did, and he was a visionary, and he is still, I think, way ahead of his time as a conservative. And you know, it's a very strange situation, which if you want to find the Mein Kampf of these times, just read the report that was put together by neocons in 92 and then updated again in the late 90s by Wolfowitz, Cheney, and others, that basically set up the whole situation. And it's clearly an attempt to, they believe that their enlightened ideas will, that our ideas are enlightened, and they really believe they're going to save the world. But so did Hitler. He believed he's going to save the world. So did Mao. So did Lenin. So did everybody of a rather religiously bent, even if they're atheists, religiously atheists like Lenin, have this almost like religious passion for their politics.
Of course, Hitler's view, when you say he felt that his mission was to save the world, was to defeat Bolshevism, which in fact was his primary agenda. He didn't want to defeat England. That's why he let the army escape at Dunkirk. That's why he sent Hess to England in 1941. He admired the English people. He didn't want anything to do with a two-front war, but we now know that Churchill and Stalin got together, signed a secret deal or an agreement or came to a rapprochement in 1948 that they would engage, 38, that they would engage Hitler in a two-front war and defeat Germany and the German people. This is Churchill. He hated the German people with a psychopathy that was amazing. To defeat Germany and the German people once and for all. This was a set-up deal from the beginning. So Hitler was lured and trapped and then decimated.
Well, in an indirect association to that, there's an example with the German people of a national karmic echo that was lured. 20 years before, they had fought World War I and lost, and they thought that they didn't really lose, so they tried again and even got burned worse. And now, 20 years after that, they didn't go to war again. So German militarism, which was an anathema or a plague for the German psyche, was finally overthrown.
Interesting observations. Wow.
They learned their lesson. Of course, they nearly destroyed themselves in the process. Yeah. These echoes happen in 20-year as well as 40-year echoes.
And as many of you listeners who are well-read know, after World War II ended, somewhere between 8 and 10 million German civilians, men, women, and children, were killed, liquidated, slaughtered, annihilated. That's another Holocaust that nobody knows about. We'll be right back with John Hogue in just a couple minutes. Do visit his website at hogueprophecy.com. Okay, and right back with John Hogue. His website is hogueprophecy.com. Do visit and buy his books. They are brilliantly researched, matchless, really, in the field. We will, of course, at the end of this year, have John back for his annual visit to give us his views on what lies ahead. We've heard something already. To the extent that we should all be on guard and very observant, very aware, keenly astute about what's going to be happening in 2007 as it leads to 2008. Tough times ahead, and that won't be the end of it, though, will it, John? I think many people are looking toward, whether it's 2012, the Mayan calendar, or whatever, there does appear to be something coming. Didn't you talk about this once, though, 2011, 2012?
Yeah,
not necessarily tied to any of that calendar stuff.
I think a lot of has been made of 2012, and Jose Arguelles has been writing about it for 20 years or so. But I think it's missing the mark. A far more significant change in history is coming starting next year through 2008. Everything that people have been waiting for in 2012 is going to happen next year.
I'm with you on this, and I've told people that we're not going to make it or need to wait to 2012 to see what happens.
Yeah, it's a time where what is basically going to happen is a shift in the grand cosmic year, which in normal years is the time it takes the position of the spring equinox to transit through all 12 tropical signs of the zodiac. It takes roughly nearly 26,000 years for that to take place. Now, if you dissect this down into more digestible units of time, a month in the cosmic year is roughly 2,000 years long. We just are leaving the month of Pisces, the age of Pisces, 2,000 years long.
This month?
It's a cosmic month in the cosmic year,
okay,
which is nearly 26,000 normal years
okay.
in length.
All right.
It's like the greatest cycle in prophecy, actually. And we are now entering the new month, Aquarius, for 2,000 normal years. If you scale down the calendar to a cosmic day, it's a 24 cosmic hour period of 72 normal years. That means that it has 36 years of day and 36 years of night. What that means is that you have things in the day period or things that are sown. It's the yang, the male, the assertive time in history. Then you have 36 years of things reaped after being sown. The harvest of good and bad actions of the previous 36 years come home to roost, for better or worse, in the next. Now, back in 1972-73 was when cosmic night moved into cosmic day. And there's many things that happened in 72-73 that have defined the last 36 years of world history. That is when international Arab terrorism, Islamic terrorism began. That was with the Munich bombings, the PLO involvement in things. It was also the time of the Yom Kippur War, which led to the OPEC oil embargo, which became the oil became the issue of world politics like it had never done before and has remained so ever since. You also had in 72 the Watergate scandal of Richard M. Nixon that in the following 36 years has led to this disconnect, is very much a part of this disconnect of the U.S. citizenry and its government with each other, caused by the scandals that made people not trust or even be interested in the legal prosecution of their government, of their laws, and governing in general, has led to this. That's what we've been seeding for the last 36 years, and now it's going to reap a harvest of crisis in the next 2 years that are going. It's probably going to take 36 years to heal in this country.
That wouldn't surprise me.
And it would also lead, as some prophecies indicate, that we are, if we don't do this right, by the 2020s, we are going to have another revolution, a violent revolution in this country, perhaps even the potential of the country breaking up into five units. That could happen. And also what could happen is a new constitution could be formed and upgraded from the original one. It would be probably for the better. But we don't have to go down that track. We can stop that track from happening. Just like if we do intelligent things in the next 10 years concerning our consumption and our overpopulation and our use of fossil fuels, we don't have to have the oceans begin to rise 10 years from now and flood our ports and disrupt our civilization. We don't have to have these things happen. And one of the most important things that for 30 years as a student of prophecy and as an interpreter of prophecy, I have learned is that the future is an echo of our actions in the present. And actions are given birth this moment, that mm-hmm. can change to another future timeline. If a critical mass of people change their individual habits, we change the future. If you remain robotic right. and predictable...
Of course, that's the game.
Yeah. And you have a system behind the government, a system mm-hmm. behind the corporocracy
mm-hmm.
That wants you all to be stupid and mechanical, because that's how you can be controlled.
And that's what the schools are producing.
Yes, and mm-hmm. and the short-term memory of they call it the consumerists. I like to call it the consumptists, mm-hmm. because it's almost like they're dying of civilization consumption. Pneumonia almost. They're keeling over. Their intelligence. I have watched over the last 2-3 cycles of new generations a new form of program short term.
You know what it is?
Happily mediocre human being that
I call it
to work on.
Very malleable, very simple to control. They do run supercomputer models of all these social engineering programs and projects. Their subtleties are boundless. They use every aspect you can think of. Imagery, sound, sight, it doesn't matter. Repetition, they've got it down. I think the American public is now reduced, John, to what I'd call, at best, just-in-time thinking.
Well, this is... And then the question that has to come up more and more, which will come up in the future, I predict, is people are going to more and more see this. People who didn't quite get turned completely into robots who still have a spark of their spontaneous intelligence intact, are going to have to seek tools that will allow them not to be seduced by this this misery field making of these people, this mind plague that's being made, this atmosphere of muddle that these people are trying to create. And what I have come to understand in my own life is that simple techniques of meditation, of being self-aware, of just being simply alert of how your mind functions, taking on the hypothesis, because meditation is not a religion, it's a question, it's an experiment that says, is there a consciousness beyond the mind that can observe the mind, and thereby through observing the mind and its mechanicalness, without judgment for or against it, do these mechanical habits simply stop functioning? And does then consciousness become a master of the body-mind once again? And that, and I'm saying something that's really far kind of future thinking here, but you're hearing it tonight, and remember it, because in the future they will look back to this as the solution to the roboticization of the human race. The greatest danger that is coming to the human race and challenge in the 21st century is not all this wars and politics and global warming and all that. That will eventually settle down in 50 years or so. And then we will enter a golden age that's foreseen by so many prophets. But there's an aspect to that golden age that is virtual. It is not authentic. And the signs of the attempt to turn a kind of artificial enlightened world, you know, being almost enlightened, like almost pregnant, is going to come to be our greatest challenge and most subtle challenge, because we will, in 50 years to 60 years' time, we will master reality as we know it. We will be able to design our bodies, our minds, our thoughts, our emotions, and our realities that we wish to explore will be even more enhanced and real than what our current mortal eyes and senses can see, which is going to bring people into a powerful collision where they either become completely soulless cogs in this illusion, or they stand as individuals and say, if everything that I see and experience is shaped and manipulated, mm-hmm. who is the manipulator?
Right.
Who am I? Who is this? What is it in me that cannot be virtual? Obviously, the experiencer of these things is not the experience. And so then you will see, beginning now, and especially flowering in the latter half of this century, a worldwide rebellion of self-observation. Because the Aquarian Age is about science. It's about, and science is the word that means to know. Not to believe, not to have superstitious faith in,
mm-hmm.
but to directly experience existentially the truth of a mystery. And that will be the, even though meditation is not a religion, it will be a tool of a new religiousness which will dominate evolution of spiritual understanding in the next 2,000 years.
Well, nicely said. I think the summation merits repeating at a future date and certainly being remembered by people now. The manipulation of this many people on such a scale is extraordinary and unprecedented, and they are really, really good at it. We will see. I've always said, John, how do you awaken an intellect when it was stillborn to begin with?
I have an answer for that in the next hour.
I figured you might. All right. Back in a couple minutes with the ever-amazing John Hoag. So don't go away, and we shall continue right after this. At politics, social engineering, and the state of affairs as they are in the United States. And politically, of course, we have any... I guess I can't use the word election like I once used to be able to. Well, so how do we wake up a society that has been... I don't think we should use the cliche dumbed down either, because they have been programmed, socially engineered, and deconstructed and then reconstructed into a brainless, mindless, reflexive, reactive, anything but proactive society. I mean, these, and there are exceptions, but generally speaking, they're automatons.
Well, this comes, Jeff, from my understanding, studying this issue from a prophetic angle, from whenever a democracy experiment devolves through time and neglect and taking for granted the freedoms of a democracy, into what I call a mobocracy. And that is, in the name of democracy, things are done that are not really very close to the model that gave birth to all of this, the Athenian democracy, where there was a much more active involvement of people. What you have is a mob rule. That is, every political system has its virtues and its failings. The problem that happens sometimes with democracy is that it lowers the quality of things you have to a popular level. The thing that most people like becomes the top thing that you can attain to. There's a certain mobocracy going on in popular music, in the arts, and now it's even happening in politics. A certain common denominator is the guidepost for people. Now, certain clever alpha male and female types that want to dominate herds of people recognize that this mobocratic habit can be manipulated. And actually, anyone who really wants to understand how it's best manipulated should endure reading Mein Kampf, because Adolf Hitler, even though he's a horrid writer, turgid, convoluted sentences, But in that book is a recipe for how you undermine democratic values. And if people would be forearmed with this kind of understanding, they would see the signs and see the manipulators before they succeed. And but we are past that now. The opportunities to stop that from coming have passed.
Right.
And actually, 2000 was really the beginning of the time where we passed stopping it from happening. So now we have to look at it another way. We have to look at, okay, it is coming. It's like if you had a hot drought and people were being told that if they didn't behave better with their fires, they'd cause a forest fire. Well, we can't prevent the forest fire. The people have been misbehaved, and there is a forest fire. So now the question has to change to how do we put it out? How do we minimize the damage? How do we prevent it from doing something catastrophically worse? And we are in a two-year period where a whole lot of people, by the end of this two-year period, are going to join a rebellion against both the Democratic and Republican Party.
Well, it's about time. I agree.
I would even say there might even be a movement towards understanding, as certain thinkers of about the future have said, that you cannot have a functioning democracy with political parties.
Interesting idea.
I don't think the Athenians had political parties, really. They voted the issue in front of them. They sent their representatives as individuals to represent them. It wasn't cliques and parties and organizations. And the problem is that the attainment of a third party, for any better word for it, rebellion, is not going to come from the grassroots, because it can't. The very fact is that there are a majority of people right now who, if they had an opportunity to vote for something beyond donkeycrats and dumbo publicans, they would.
But
they can't, because it's been stopped. The fire is on.
Sure.
The fire against their freedom. Now, what I foresee as a possibility for this rebellion would be if people who were voted, Republicans and Democrats, who in this coming election come into the 2006-2007 Congress, decided that one day a number of them, several dozen of them in either House and Senate, decided to abandon the Republican and Democrat parties and become a wedge, with a manifesto of certain ideas that look at ways to find balance and fairness in the political dialogue, not partisanship.
Yeah, I agree.
And it cannot happen any other way, as I foresee it, because these Republicans and Democrats have created such a duopoly, that's a two people in a monopoly, that there's no other political discourse that can happen. There's no way that fiscally conservative but tolerant socially people can meet, or vice versa. There's no place where Americans can talk about simply the things that we all share and value as Americans, beyond the right to choose, our beliefs, our religions, and all that, are these basic values that make the dream of America vital to us, are lost in this gridlock of two mafias, who are really the same mafia. So it's incumbent upon, and I am going to actually, after this election, write a manifesto where I will send it through emails to every elected official, inviting them to abandon their party.
What are you going to call it?
I'm going to call it the American Party.
You call it Mein Kampf Part 2.
No, it's the American Party.
Well, I like that.
Because,
kind of old-fashioned,
because
but
it's not a, well, it's more than that. In politics, you look at ideas as a collective symbolic ideas. And then one thing
it does, John. I don't mean old-fashioned in a negative sense. It does harken back to what people talk about conservatism. I always called it preservatism.
Yeah, preservatism. I am a preservatist. I want to preserve the founding fathers' dream for our country.
See, that could be the motto of your party, preservative.
But preservative sounds like a laxative.
No, preserve is important in politics.
It's important in politics to find something that a lot of people can identify with as an interesting theme. One thing we all are, whether we're red, blue, or purple, we're all American.
Don't leave us green people out.
Blue, purple, green, libertarian, vegetarian, whatever.
That too.
We're all American. We all have a stake in America and being American. So a party that, you know, Rothbard had the Reform Party, but the problem is if the Reform Party ever got into power, it would be kind of an oxymoron to call it the Reform Party.
He was told to get out.
That's another issue. But the issue is that if you want something that's a name that, I mean, we can all disagree on a lot of things, but if you're a citizen of this country, of this democracy, you can agree that...
That's common ground.
We're all American.
Yeah.
And so why not create a party that is fair and balanced to the rights and free individual freedoms, to the Goldwater principle of being an independent American. And that I think, what I'm voicing is not just something I'm feeling. I'm sure many of you out there are already feeling this wellspring of a certain collective energy coming up of people who want to be to find an answer beyond this current
the two party scam is dead in the water. It's going nowhere. People have, I think, awakened. But I think you're right. I think what you're talking about. It's an intuitive, almost a psychic awareness now that this system is finished in its current incarnation.
But
can't work.
They have this beautiful internet, this beautiful
so far
new tool. Yeah, use it while you can. Where the free access of ideas are there. I mean, one of the things that really strikes me about my work and my Hoag Prophecy Bulletins, which you can become a member by linking to my website, get these free bulletins that kind of try to tie current events to prophetic.
They're fascinating.
And one of the things that I find remarkable in the letters I get from all over the world is I'm writing about, for instance, the war in Iran, and both sides are reading me. Because
really?
The internet is open.
Yeah.
So I have a responsibility to speak to the perceptions or misperceptions of both sides.
I agree, and it is fascinating because John and I and many people online can, and they all can, but many of them can and do, actually track and see who visits them. So we know who's visiting our sites and reading our material. And fascinating. Kind of a who's who of them, and then a who's who of us. And they're all there.
And then there's just all of us.
Yeah. I like that. We'll see. Back in a minute with John, and if you look at the top of headlines at Rents.com, right up near the top, second story, you'll see Nostradamus dating a U.S. war prepared against Iran. Let's see what John has to say about that. It is, in fact, a Hoag Prophecy Bulletin. I would urge all of you, if you're remotely interested in following up upon what you're hearing presented to you tonight, to subscribe to the bulletin and get it. Back after this. Okay, the headline reads, Nostradamus dating a U.S. war prepared against Iran. It's written by John Hoag. It's one of his bulletins. And that's interesting. Looks like the master has stepped up to the plate once again and made solid contact. You know, the Americans love those sports metaphors.
Yes, he's going for a home run. And the ball that he is using is one that several balls that shine in the sky as planets.
Mm-hmm.
Because even though Nostradamus is well known for his astrology, his History of the Future, his Book of Prophecies, which has over 1,600 predictions in it, 36,000 words all together, mostly in four-line quatrain poems, has only 70 references to astrological configurations.
Huh.
So whenever he felt like he had to quote one, it was obviously for some very important shift in human destiny.
Uh-huh.
And over the years, since I wrote Nostradamus, The Complete Prophecies, and published it back in 1997. It was the first complete examination of all his prophecies since 1961. And it's still available in bookstores, especially at Barnes & Noble.
Still have my copy you sent me? Thank you.
No, it's a good door jam. It's about 1,000
pages. Not quite.
Anyway, the thing that intrigued me was this prophecy, which is from Century 9, or Volume 9 of the prophecies, Quatrain number 55, which said, a horrible war, which is being prepared in the West, the following year the pestilence will come, so very horrible that young nor old nor animal may survive. Blood, fire, Mercury, Mars, Jupiter, and France. Now, first thing you gain from this is that the secret to understanding Nostradamus is see the future not from your country, but from how it affects France. Because he was very much identified in his view of the world through French rose-colored glasses.
Mm-hmm.
Or alchemical colored glasses, I should say.
Kind of a Cabernet Red Mountain Red glasses.
Yes, the Cote de Rhone.
That's
probably
it.
More what he drank.
That's it.
Because he was born in Saint-Rémy. But anyway, so many people write about Nostradamus and they do the opposite. They fixate on their particular country and think that Nostradamus, for instance, seven scholars in Japan think Nostradamus only was interested in far off Japan. And in Russia, same thing happens. In America, same thing happens. But the key is to understand that he's seeing things in his realm, in his corner of the world. And because the Middle East was relatively near to South France, he says a lot about issues and focuses a lot about the future of the Muslim empire, of the Ottoman Turks, or the Islamic empires, saying in one key prophecy that their empire would be renewed, hopes for their empire would be renewed by the discovery of a new source of wealth. That new source of wealth
uh-huh.
is oil.
Uh-huh.
And he used the word renewal, which in Arabic is Ba'ath.
What is it?
The Ba'athist Party.
Oh, B-A-A-T-H? Really?
Yes.
Oh.
It is a organization which actually Western leaders have been trying to subvert
yeah.
ever since it started because of the danger of it.
In their minds. Party, right? Yeah.
Yeah, is that it's an attempt to unite all Arab-speaking, Islamic-worshipping people to the world. Arabic-speaking and worshipping into a super-nation that controls all the oil
and
is a caliphate.
Of course, the effort has been, for the better part of a century now, to keep the Arabs divided and fighting amongst themselves.
And no doubt if that corner of the world had the dominant military force, they would be trying to do the same thing, dividing a union in Europe or a union in America. I'm not standing in judgment of their aims. It's simply what national bodies do, but the ones that succeed usually have more of a gun. And the Arab world has not had the military might to stop the West from keeping them divided. And after the Ottoman Empire collapsed, after World War II, a lot was done to divide the Arab world into states that had the smallest sheikdoms owning the most oil. And the vast populated centers, except for Iraq, which they couldn't quite handle, have the least amount of oil.
Well, they carved off Kuwait from southern Iraq, which had always been Iraqi territory. And of course, the Kuwaitis were slant drilling, taking Saddam's oil. And
into the Ramallah oil fields. Yeah.
Right, that's right. And all these little sheikdoms of the United Arab Emirates, Dubai, all that, were all what John is talking about. Little tiny fiefdoms, if you will, set up to run a small population covering a fairly substantial amount of oil
yeah.
with a corrupt, despotic, lackey regime. That's what we've had.
And the one group that after World War I they couldn't control is the Persians.
Never have been able to control the Persians. Now, most Americans, if you were to ask them, John, I know I'm not preaching, most of my audience is pretty smart. If you were to ask the average Americans, is there any difference between Iraqis, Iranians, Syrians, they wouldn't get it. The Persians are an entirely different race, a cultural race at any rate. It's a different group of people. They're not what you think of as normal Muslims.
Jews and Arabs belong to the Semite culture.
Correct.
Race. Persians are Aryan.
As in Aryan.
Yes, unfortunately.
All right. Hold on, gang. We'll be right back with John Hogue in just a couple minutes. Talking with John Hogue, brilliant analyst of not only Nostradamus but of current events, from a prophetic viewpoint, but far more than any normal prophet you would ever think. All right, John, the issue we're talking about now is Nostradamus, and that's a very, I'm not an expert, of course, never will be, but having read much of your work, and I read this as a very cogent, very dense, very powerful quatrain.
It is, and it has been one that has fascinated me since 1997, because this astrological confluence of planets. Now, it's clear that he did not say these planets were in conjunction. That means that they were in exact degrees of each other. That doesn't mean he didn't mean that they were in conjunction. He just left that open, mm-hmm. which is something Nostradamus often did, to cryptically describe things so that people could gather, the initiate could gather information and see things before they happen. But at the same time, you don't want to make things too clear for people who are evil who want to read Nostradamus and see things they shouldn't do so that their dark futures can happen. For instance, I've often argued that if Nostradamus had been clearer about Saddam Hussein, that even Saddam Hussein could have read his name in it, he might not have taken the sting operation that got him into the Kuwait conflict. He might have waited 5-6 years, and then this war might have happened when he was a nuclear power.
True.
And it would have been a very different outcome. So the responsibility of the prophet to find a perfect balance between hiding and obscuring the future so that it can happen potentially for the better, opposed to the worse, is why, as a scholar of Nostradamus, I try to find those things in a prophecy that unlock the obscurity, that clear it, that blow it clean. And one of the things that happens here is that when Mercury, Mars, and Jupiter come together in the same zodiacal sign, that happens about every couple of years. So one then looked in modern history at any time when the West was preparing a great war. The implication being is if the West is preparing a war, it's going to be against the East. Because why even mention West if it isn't versus East? This is kind of a Renaissance way of using grammar, that if you get to understand Nostradamus, you've got to start thinking like people did back in the 16th century. A lot of things they like to really say, they said between the lines. Or if you mentioned one, you really meant you were after the other. So if you're saying the war is being prepared in the West, it means the West is preparing a war against the East. Now you got to ask, what was East for Nostradamus? We think of East, we think of China.
Sure.
For Nostradamus, it's the Middle East. Because of the terms that he uses in 16th century French, he's talking about the Near East. He's talking about the modern Iraq, Persia, all that area. So a war then must be prepared there. So what you then do is you look at modern history and say, well, there haven't been until relatively recent, the last 50 years, an interest in conflicts in the Middle East. And that interest came because of the interest of oil and the need of oil in our modern society. So then you start looking at those 2 to 3 year to sometimes 4 year confluences of those three planets. You start seeing a very interesting pattern begin in 1998, then again in 2002, then again in 2004, and right now in 2006, October into November. What you see is Mercury, Mars, and Jupiter coming together. Actually, the first time that it drew my attention was, happened to be the very day in, I think it was the 23rd of February, 1998, the very day when those were all conjoined together was the day that Kofi Annan, the Secretary General of the United Nations, was speaking to Saddam Hussein in Baghdad to stop a conflict with the weapons inspectors of that time from turning into a full-scale war against Clinton's America, who were threatening airstrikes.
Clinton's America.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They were threatening airstrikes. And so then you say, okay, that's a very interesting thing happening. Okay, in the following year, was there a horrible war? Well, there was war, but it wasn't the following year. It was actually, that happened in February, that meeting. In December of 1998, the inspectors were thrown out again, and there was an airstrike situation. And then Iran ended up in this low-scale war with America in the no-fly zone wars that
Iraq.
That didn't end until Iraq was invaded in 2003, now by a new administration. Now, that hits on some of the prophecy's important point, but there was no great pestilence. There was not some really horrible war. When Nostradamus uses a word like horrible, it's not some little war that may be horrible to you. It's a war that's horrible for the whole world. All war is horrible. But, you know, he doesn't use that word very often. So it's important that he uses it as a qualifier. So that didn't happen in 1998. So the next time you look, you see a war planned by Western powers, and the same conjunction happens again in another sign in 2002, right around the time in September or July of 2002, or right around the summer and autumn it happened, just when war plans were in full swing to in the West, in America, the superpower of the West, to invade Iraq, which happened in March of 2003. The following year, a very horrible war comes.
Right.
But again, unless this is the dating the beginning of the war, and now several years later there's going to be a new turn in the war that causes a pestilence, up to this point some pestilence that kills young, old, and animals has not happened. Not yet. So even though that still is a viable dating for the beginning of the horrible war, it did the following year that it came didn't see this pestilence. And of course, when I'm talking about pestilence, I'm not talking about spent uranium bullets from Warthog tank busters in Iraq. We're talking about something that will actually depopulate the entire Middle Eastern region in something that sounds obviously a pestilence that's man-made. Nostradamus often talks about the third conflict being a lot of man-made pestilences. We're talking about weapons of mass destruction. We're talking about radiological fallout, chemical and biological weapons, anthrax, things like this, which, by the way, the potential combatants in a war, Iran, though it doesn't have nuclear weapons and probably won't for a decade, has a prodigious chemical and biological weapons arsenal. So does Israel, and also they have 600 nuclear weapons. And so do we. So, the U.S., so more on this after the ad, and why the next two confluences are really pointing to our times as the times.
All right, this is very interesting, and maybe one of the most important quatrains you've ever discussed here. I
think it certainly is for our time, because out of this may come World War III.
All right, we will continue after this. We'll be right back. let's rejoin John Hogue. There was a rabbi. There are several organizations who are staunchly anti-Zionist. One of them made a statement that, in fact, many of them have, that Israel should not exist. They're not in favor of the state of Israel. They don't believe there's a need for it, and so on and so forth. What did Nostradamus have to say about Israel, or did he talk about it very much in his quatrains to the best of your ability?
He did. I'll just mention a few things about it, because there's some more steps in the time left that we may...
Okay.
It's kind of taken us away from the...
Well,
the
let's put it off for another day, then.
Let's
go back to your line of thought, please.
Yes. I'll just simply say this, that he talked about a war dispute against lands, and he described the three combatants as Syria, Jordan, and Egypt, and it would last 6 days, and he's talking about a six-day war in 67. But anyway, there's much more to that, and you can read that in books like Nostradamus, The New Millennium, which extensively looks at Nostradamus' prophecies, among other things, his prophecies about Israel and its future.
Okay.
But, and I would also add that since I put out this bulletin where I talked about naval air bases near me having a tremendous amount of activity and then just all the roaring jets disappearing, and then I'm finding on internet that they're all on station in three strike groups, two carrier, right in the Persian Gulf and the Arabian Sea. When I brought that out, the power of internet allowed people from all over the world to relate similar stories in England, in Israel, and other places, showing a heightened activity of military jets and helicopters seemingly ramping up for something very big. So what then are these astrological signs saying about that something very big? Well, the next conjunction, even closer than the last, that happened in 2004 when September moved into October, if in the bulletin I show that there was ongoing plans for a war, a strike, an airstrike against Iran. There were probes being put out to feelers to Turkey to open its airspace. There were considerations for using tactical nuclear weapons against hardened sites in Iran. That Seymour Hersh and others also were reporting starting around that time and afterwards that special commandos were already on the ground marking over three dozen targets for destruction that were involved in ethnic groups that wanted to rebel against the Iranian majority were being talked to and aided. And so a number of things were starting to prepare for the war. So the West is preparing a war. So here we have that cycle again. The thing is that no war came the following year. There was already a war, a deepening crisis in Iraq. So again, it's not quite hitting, and there was no pestilence. Now, at the very few days after the huge armadas of the United States were positioned off the Persian Gulf and the Gulf of Arabia, we had a new confluence of these planets around the 22nd and 24th of just recently, just a few days ago. So now they're on station, and now what they're currently doing is a lot of activity around this area where it almost looks like a Gulf of Tonkin incident is being attempted by the current administration. So much provocation,
right,
so many jets flying near Iranian airspace. The Strait of Hormuz is chock full of ships of the Iranian Navy, the U.S. Navy, minesweepers. It's like it's almost like daring them to hit us, the U.S. And of course, if that were to happen, or if it were fabricated,
there you go. We'll go with option number two. There.
Then the opposition to the war would be nil. And as Scott Ritter said just recently on an interview with Seymour Hersh on C-SPAN...
Yesterday.
Yes, that both parties, Democrat and Republican, have a pro-hit Iran mindset anyway. So even if the Democrats took over one of the houses, they might be not so hard to seduce into
doing it again.
Well,
of course, if it became politically... expedient, they would jump on any bandwagon. That's just who those people are.
Now, go ahead. Now we come to the really fascinating thing that not only takes this three planets prediction of Nostradamus towards a horrible war with pestilence in the following year to a head. But it matches another prophecy talked about, which I've also published in my bulletin, another hint astrologically to the coming of this great war, as a time when Mars and Saturn are equally fiery. That means they're in fire sign. Now, both the three planets on the 10th and 11th, if you look at the whole world, is one calendar, 10th and 11th, because those 2 days happening, of December, you have Mercury, Mars, and Jupiter exactly 3 degrees Sagittarius. Not only are they together, they are literally on top of each other, which is very, very rare. So that is a significant statement in the, if it's meant by the prophecy as this is when the plan is about to move into reality.
Mm-hmm.
Add to that the fact that Mars will have entered Sagittarius and will be entrined in harmonious aspect for war with Leo, Saturn and Leo, equally fiery. That's happening again. The last time those two were together, and it related directly to the Middle Eastern war because Saturn and Mars are also in the chart of Israel together in a fire sign, you had this Lebanese war that just happened. It happened literally when that started, and which was a big preliminary step towards this next escalation, which could happen as soon as around the 7th to the 12th of December, but can also happen throughout January. Now, some interesting things to think about. If the November election ends with one house going to the Democrats, the neoconservative movement will no longer have its rubber stamp policies from the Congress dominated by its yes men, its do-nothing yes men. That means that if there's going to be a completion of many of the goals of destroying the axis of evil, they're going to have to move very fast, because by the end of January, a new Congress comes in that's going to try to circumvent all military action. So the onus and the pressure, if there's a loss of one or two houses, would be for Bush to go ahead with the war, whatever he could, however he could try. Now, if the Republican majority is retained either by fraud or by honest vote, then the war might be postponed until next summer, but it will come, and it might even be worse because it will have the support of a rubber stamp Congress. So these are the things that are facing us in the ballot decision.
Yeah, I'd call them worse than rubber stamp, but the worst Congress in history.
Yeah, I mean it's an amazing Congress, and I mean it's something I've tried to corner local Democrat leaders as well as Republicans. The very lame excuse that John Kerry and others have said is, well, you know, we believe the president, he didn't. And he lied to us. Well, the oath of the Constitution is that the Congress is to be a counterbalancing, just like the Supreme Court and the executive branch are all counterbalancing and skeptical of each other to protect the rights of this country. One, by being, very nature, being a member of Congress, should be skeptical of anything the executive branch says and check its facts. You don't just blindly surrender to it. And my God, Democrat or Republican, this Congress since 9/11 has just, when the president says jump, they say how high. When the president takes away freedoms in the Patriot Act, they say how many. And that's brought us to this crisis
on things
of fascism in this country.
That's right. They vote on things without those things even being in print, let alone having read them. They don't do anything except say...
Them.
No, they don't read them. They're not even printed. After the Patriot Act wasn't even printed when it was passed. I mean, these people, every single one of them should be thrown out. I'm sorry, there's a few good ones in there, but let them hang out a term and come back again. We need to clean house totally. They're all worthless scum. Sorry, that's just the way it is. What has been done about any of this? Who has mounted a challenge against the